session number 18475, Reel 1.
Arnold Baldwin, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Victoria, British Columbia, Canada.
Were your parents Canadian?
No, they were both immigrants from Britain. My mother from Northampton, where her family had lived for several generations. And my father from London. He was born in, I think, Southwark. His family was of mixed nationality. I think it would be his grandfather who came to this country from Germany. I just don't know when. I know very little of my father's family due to the fact that my parents' marriage was very much a fiasco, really. It broke up as soon as he returned from the First World War. I don't think he fancied settling down, especially in Canada, because I was still in Canada at the time when the war ended. And after he was demobbed, he couldn't find work in Canada at all. The conditions in Canada, both then and later in the world slump, were far worse in Canada than they were in the States. Not generally realised, I don't think. Excuse me. And the marriage broke up, and my mother so much hated the memory of my father that I learned very little of his family at all. So I don't know much about them, but I do know that somewhere along the line is either my father's father or his grandfather had come from Germany, that's all I know. And they'd anglicised the name from a German name into Baldwin. So
do you think of yourself as a Canadian or an Englishman?
Canadian, very much. As a matter of fact, it's rather strange that I've never bothered to apply for Canadian citizenship. But some years ago, when I needed a passport, I had to, have a birth certificate. And I hadn't got one, of course. So I wrote to, I visited Canada House, that was it. I went to Canada House and told them that I needed a copy of my birth certificate. Gave them the details of when and where I was born, name and all the necessary details, and bless my soul, they had a copy of my birth certificate back in about 3 days. Well, I left it at that, and I never had any more dealings with Canada until about 3 years ago. And a sister-in-law took my wife, my late wife, that is, I'm afraid she died last year. She took us to Canada on a holiday. We went on a tour of the Rockies and so on, and that is the sole connection I've had with Canada since leaving there at the age of about 6. But I do have very strong feelings towards Canada indeed, and I so much enjoyed my visit, and I was so much impressed by a lot of the things that not only the Canadian government was doing, but the provincial government of British Columbia as well, in conservation and that sort of thing, that the protection of animals, and also they did seem to be improving their attitude, I think, towards the native Canadians who they call the First People. And this is happening a lot in the States as well, I think.
You appear to have come to England when, in 1919?
I think 1919, as near as I can tell.
So you were mostly educated in England?
Totally educated in England. So for the amount of education I had, yes.
Whereabouts?
Well, my mother was absolutely infatuated with Canada. There's no other word for it. And she married, and I was born on her third visit to Canada. She'd gone there as a young girl of about 17 as a companion to an older sister who'd married, and this man had gone out there in the belief, a lot of people had it in those days, I think largely middle-class people with money, that if they went out to British Columbia, it was a great fruit-growing area, particularly what was known as the Okanagan Valley in British Columbia, where apparently they didn't only grow apples, they grew gold on the trees as well, I think. This was the idea. And my mother's oldest sister, who'd recently married, went with her husband, and she wanted my mother, as a young girl of 17 then, to accompany her as a companion. And after a fairly short run, the husband, who'd been fairly well to do, I think he'd been something in the shipping business in England, and he was used to the West End clubs and this sort of life. He found pioneering there was a bit too much for him, so they came back. And of course my mother, who was still, she was over age, I suppose, by then, 18 or so, she had to come back as well, but it wasn't long before she went back again. And then she came home again. I think she used to run into financial troubles and so on, and her family in Northampton were always bailing her out of situations like that. She went back for the third time and married in 1912. I was born in 1913. My father went off to the war quite early in the war, as I understand it. And when he returned from service in the war, he just didn't seem to fancy the situation. There was no real feeling between them, either of them. They'd married purely, it was convenience for both of them, I think. He was a man who needed a woman, that's pretty definite. And my mother was about, I don't know, 12 to 14 years older than he was. And when he was over here, he spent a lot of time in Glasgow, where there were plenty of girls up there who were happy to encourage Canadian soldiers. And he was so used to that sort of life that going back to Canada and finding he'd got a kid and an older wife and one thing and another, he was supposed to be looking for work, but he disappeared. And my mother had one bad habit, which she never cured herself of, and that was delving around in other people's letters and so on. And of course, she picked up a letter to him from one of these birds in Glasgow. And the references to her in the letter were so scatological that I don't wonder she hated him for it. And that was the breakup, really. He just was allegedly going to find work in another town, leaving my mother and myself there. And she had to write home, as she'd done in the past, to ask for the funds to get herself back over here again.
So did you grow up in Northampton?
No. My mother was one of those shall I say, lower middle class women. They had very limited ability to earn living. One thing they did, they worked in the large draper's stores all over the place, mostly in live-in accommodation, people like Derry and Toms and others like that. She worked for those. The only other thing she could do when she got back with me from Canada was she couldn't any longer do that work. The only work open was what they called in those days, I think, a cook general. They lived in a well-to-do house, and they did the cooking and generally kept the house. Well, she found difficulty there to find such a job where they would also accommodate me. So she put me into, she was lucky to do it, but she put me into a boys' home near Farlingham in Kent. It was pretty rugged, but it was a fair place, and it gave you an elementary education, and then there was no possibility, no matter how academic your abilities were, you got no further than an elementary education. After that, you had the choice of a trade to learn. The home was quite a remarkable place, really, because it was almost self-sufficient in that you could be taught carpentry and joinery, in which case those who were learning carpentry and joinery did most of the maintenance work around. The was not one building, there were houses containing 30 people each, and there were 11 of those houses. So 30 people to a house, and one was a hospital. I forget what the other one was. So that there was plenty to do for anyone learning carpentry and joinery for a start. Also, they were learning to be tailors, and they made all our clothes. Others were learning to be boot and shoemakers, and they made our boots. And others, they had a very substantial farm there. So that provided most of the produce that we needed. And generally, it was a self-supporting community, almost. So anyway, the thing was that it limited anybody to what they used to call hewers of wood and drawers of water, wasn't it? I think that was the term for it. And that's what it meant. My mother, as soon as she'd put me in there, went straight back to Canada again. And occasionally on a holiday in the summer, I would visit my aunts and my grandfather in Northampton. But finally, at the age of 20, I was fully trained as a carpenter and joiner, and I got my first job then in 1933 at the age of 20.
Is that what you were doing when war broke out?
Yes. Yes, I was. But my mother had returned. I have to say this, that who's the well-known poet laureate who said, I quote, "Your parents, they fuck you up." Have you heard the expression?
Ted Hughes? Ted Hughes?
No, it wasn't Ted Hughes.
I don't know. I've never heard the phrase.
Well, that is in one of his poems, and I can testify to the accuracy of that anyway. Because they did me no favours, either of them. As I say, my mother, having put me in this home, then went straight back to Canada because she loved Canada above all things. But when I was nearing the finish of my apprenticeship, as it were, things got very, very tough in Canada again. Very tough. The intention had been that when I finished there at the school, I would go out to Canada and work out there. But I got letters from her with newspaper cuttings about gangs of hobos riding the rails and menacing different towns. They would simply raid towns. They were near starvation point, a lot of them. There was no point in going to Canada in that, at that time. I don't suppose you would have been accepted anyway. They got so much trouble, unemployed on their hands. So I simply got work here. And I wrote to my mother and told her that I'd now left and I was working. And 3 weeks later, I got a card to say she was on board ship coming home again. Well, I wasn't happy about that because I'd got myself a job. I'd got myself some decent lodgings. This was in Sutton, where I got my first job. I got good lodgings there and I could just cope with my wages. I learned later that I was being grossly underpaid by the builder I was working for, but I found that out within a year. But I could manage it, paying my lodgings and generally live. And then I got this card from my mother, she's coming home. She only used me as a meal ticket, that's pretty obvious. And the difference was that I then had to find more permanent accommodation for her as well as myself. So I had to, in those days, lots of people who were buying houses and so on couldn't really cope with their mortgages and so on, and they used to let off half their house. And that's what we did to start with. Well, in fact, we did that right up until the war.
Now,
yes.
When did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Oh, yes.
What was your reaction to that?
Well, tell you the truth, I was a very political being. Very political. I was very anti-Nazi, very anti-fascist. Very anti-Chamberlain and his government, who I thought were a load of bums. They were, some of them were, really were pro-Nazi, I think. We've had a long period of what has been known as the Cold War. Well, the first few months of World War II was known as the Phony War, because although we declared war on Germany, we didn't do damn all about it. We didn't do anything. It sacrificed a few unfortunate bomber pilots' lives in going over to places like Kiel and Hamburg and cities like that and dropping leaflets telling them that they were being very naughty and they shouldn't do things like this. And that was about what our war effort comprised of for the first few months. And as I say, it was known as the Phony War. And
had you been a member of a political party?
I had.
Which party had you joined?
I was a member of the Young Communist League.
In Sutton?
No, not in Sutton, no. I'd attempted in 1936 when Franco launched his attack on the Spanish Republic. I was then well politicised, you might say, and I made a couple of attempts to go to Spain on the Republican side, but for various reasons I was unable to do it. In fact, there was a very well-known journalist who used to write for what was then a liberal newspaper, the News Chronicle. And just after Franco's attack, he wrote an article. He'd been involved in the Greek fight for liberation against the Turks at the end of the First World War. And he was well-known on for this. Well, he then wrote this article in the News Chron in support of the Spanish Republican government and saying that if anybody, this was before the international brigades were formed, if anybody wished to volunteer to go to Spain, get in touch with him. So I wrote to him, but the letter I got back from him, I told him that I was a carpenter and joiner and so on. I got a letter back saying he was sorry, but he couldn't put me forward because what they really needed were lorry drivers and communications people, radio or phone, that sort of thing. So he couldn't send me. Well,
what was the name of this chap?
I wish I could remember.
Doesn't matter. Man.
No, I've many times I've tried to recall his name. He was a well-known man, quite well-known in the political world, but he was, at that time, I don't think he was attached to any party or anything of that sort. He was a well-known liberal.
So what did you do when you got that turning down?
Well, then I thought, well, the Communist Party is sending people. So I thought, well, I'll go and apply to the Communist Party. I'd friends who were communists. So although I hadn't joined myself, I dithered a bit. But I think it was the outbreak of the Civil War in Spain which finally hardened my opinions enough to do something about it. And knowing that the Communist Party was sending people, I went up to the Communist headquarters in King Street. And after a good deal of unbolting, unlocking and unbarring, the door opened. And I think they had a lot of problems then, I think, keeping Scotland Yard out of the place. And three blokes came out to interview me on the pavement and asked me what the hell I wanted and so on. And when I told them that I was hoping they'd send me to Spain, they said, oh, sorry, but all our membership wants to go. The only recommendation I could give them was I was a trade union member. I couldn't give them any political experience, but I was a member of my trade union. And I was active in the trade union. I was a shop steward and I was the president of my local branch and so on. I told them this, convinced them of my left-wing credentials, or working-class credentials, rather. And they said, no, all of our membership wants to leave to go to Spain, and we're sending some of them over. But if you really want to help Spain, this was the time of the British government had already formulated the policy of what was called non-intervention, which was a complete farce anyway. It was an intervention really on behalf of Franco. They said, and there was a campaign that was launched by the Communist Party in this country, Arms for Spain, just to give the Spanish government the ability to buy arms, because they put the block on the sale of arms to the Spanish government, and they blockaded the Spanish ports. And of course the Italian Navy blockaded the other ports, so really they were deprived of purchasing arms. I think they got some from the Soviet Union which were flown in, I assume. They may have got some into Barcelona by boat.
So did you get involved in the Arms for Spain movement?
Yes. So then they said, you better go back and campaign for Arms for Spain. And they said, where do you come from? And I said, Croydon. Oh, they said, we've just starting a branch of the Young Communist League in Croydon, and we've got a bloke there. He's on his own at the moment. So if you want to help Spain, you go down and find this bloke. They gave me his name and address. Join up with him and the Young Communist League, and then go out and campaign for Arms for Spain. So I said, right, I'll do that, which I did.
So is that when you joined the YCL?
Yes, that was 36, yeah, later in 36.
Who was the other chap?
Oh, his name was... he's long disappeared. He turned Trotskyist in the end anyway, so... there was very much swapping and chopping and changing. People losing their enthusiasms and finding new ones, and so it was a very funny period. But it was heavily politicised. I mean, there is no politics today at all, is there? It's just non-existent.
So did you then become politically active from 36?
Yes, I did, yeah. I was politically active when I joined the army. I made no bones about it. Now, why did I join the army? as I've just remarked, the early months of the war were known as the phony war because simply nothing happened. It seemed like it was just a con. Well, I was never inclined militarily. The military life didn't appeal to me. I didn't mind going and fighting, but I didn't want to stay in a depot square bashing all the time. That's not the sort of thing that I fancy at all. I'll submit to discipline, but I don't like too much bull. And at that time, early in, late 39, the government thought it would be, or the War Office or somebody, thought it would be a good idea if building companies, they selected about four or five building companies in the London region, who formed from their workforce what became known as RE companies, artisan and works companies they were called, AW companies, about...
Is this part of the Royal Engineers?
Yes, yes. Oh, definitely, it was part of the Royal Engineers, but it was so different because how many would there be of us? Four, 30s, about 120 men, I think, in each of these companies. The idea was that the inducements were considerable for somebody like myself who didn't want much. There was no, as I say, there was no military activity. So if you did join the army and were called up, you simply bashed around on a square somewhere. With this, the promises were quite unique. In the first place, cash. The ordinary private in the army then got 2 shillings a day. If you went into one of these companies, the REs had a scale of pay according to craftsmanship and so on. And if you were a skilled craftsman, you got 5 shillings a day. Well, 5 shillings against 2 shillings was worth consideration. And also, another lure that they gave us was that all the drill that you would actually do would be about 3 weeks at Chatham. You would then go straight to France, where you would be engaged on building fortifications.